So the Ramah lived 1520 to 1572, only 52 years. His father, whose name was Yisrael or Israel, thus his name Rav Moshe Israelis. What? Over here. Okay, look at that. Yisrael Israel. Was a Talmud Chacham, and he was independently wealthy. He probably headed the community. His grandfather was Rav Yechiel Luria, who was the first Rav of Brisk. And he studied in Lublin under Rabbi Shalom Shachna, whose kever we saw last week, who later became his father-in-law. And among his Talmidim was his relative, and later one of his biggest Cholkim, the Maharshal, whom we discussed also last week. The Ramah's first wife died at 20, and he established the Ramah Shul in Krakow in her memory, which may have been also his house originally, and converted into the shul built by his father in his honor. And he later remarried the sister of the Sheris Yosef. In about 1550, he returned to Krakow and established the yeshiva, which he supported at his own cost. And in 1553, he became a dayan. And he, 1553, he was 33. And on his kever, I believe on the other side, it says, "Lo mi Moshe lo Moshe lo kam ke Moshe." Oh, it says it here?
This is, of course, a copy of what's on the other side, so you were right.
Okay, good. I just remember seeing it on the other side and didn't spot it here yet. Mi Moshe an Moshe lo kam ke Moshe. And I first thought, wow, since Moshe Rabbeinu, but when I read that it was actually part of somebody's hesped for him, and it was referring to the Rambam, so from the Rambam to the Ramah, there was nobody else as great as the Ramah. That is the praise of the Ramah. The Ramah wrote the Mappah, the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, which we're going to discuss in a second, both countered the Shulchan Aruch's authority and upheld it. The Ramah was not known for taking minhag lightly, and he did his best to uphold them, though once in a while he was willing to repudiate them when they were baseless. His derech was to first go to the Gemara, then the Rishonim, and he follows the majority. But even the Rambam is discounted when his is the minority view. And this brings him in contrast to the Shulchan Aruch, who, it's always the same three, Rambam, Rif, and Rush. He also used early Achronim, the Mordechai, the Ashri, the Tur, and he especially likes follow, especially when any of those follow Tosfot. Beyond that, he uses tshuvot of later authorities because he held halachic batrai, especially when it came to Polish customs, which the Beit Yosef omitted. So he originally wrote, he was writing the Darche Moshe, which was a commentary on the Torah, and he wanted it to serve as the basis for subsequent halachic positions, and all of a sudden the Beit Yosef was published. And he looked at it and said, hey, this is most of my goals. So, which is a tremendous lesson in humility. To, you're right, who publishes first? It's a big deal. He said, you know what? You don't need my sefer anymore. So he actually published a shorter version of the Darkei Moshe. So actually, that one's called the Darkei Moshe now, and the original one is referred to as Darkei Moshe Aruch. It does exist. Certain printings of it have it in the back, on the side, on the bottom, etc. But the bridge version is published with every Torah. And later, when the Shulchan Aruch wrote the, you know, the Mechaber wrote, instead of the Beit Yosef, wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote the Mappah, the tablecloth, Keilu, to the set table of the Shulchan Aruch. So there he discusses only when Sephardi and Ashkenazi psak or customs differ. Because Rav Cairo's Rambam, Rush, and Rif, so the Rambam and Rif are completely Sephardi. The Rush had some non-Sephardic roots because he lived in Germany a bit, but even he later moved to Spain. So he felt it was necessary to add Ashkenazi custom. And since 1578, all versions of the Shulchan Aruch print them both together. But while commenting on the Mechaber and saying, let me add this point and let me add that point about Ashkenazi custom, he's essentially establishing the Mechaber as the authoritative text. Because he's saying, he's right always, except where I make my comments. So though he's disagreeing with him and saying, not just these three, he's also saying, but he's right, his conclusions are right, he is authoritative, And that is why, as we discussed, the Marshal wasn't just taking, even though the Ramban Mechaber disagreed slightly, their approach was rather similar, and the Marshal was against both of them. I thought of two tshuvas that I would discuss. So one Rav Shalom discussed already was about the Friday night wedding. I will only add that I already mentioned to you, I attended the previous Shabbos, the shir on the Derech Psaker of Liechtenstein, and Rav Moshe Liechtenstein said that his father held that tshuva of the Ramah about the wedding as a very important example, because the Ramah first spends a few paragraphs discussing the case and discussing the tsar and the feelings of the people involved and what a tough situation it was. And then he goes on about 2-3 pages in very small print. When I looked at the printing, meaning not just in the Bar Ilan version, I looked at the actual printing. And before he discussed the whole sugya, he was relating to the cave of people. And he said Rav Liechtenstein felt that was a very important issue, and he was very bothered. He had come across a tshuva about, I don't know if it was about abortions or birth control or in vitro and all sorts of discussions like that. And the person was haphazardly, I don't know, being machmir a lot of the time and just discussing the sugya. And he wasn't relating to the agmas nefesh of couples who were going through those tzaros. And he felt that that was an avla. That's what he said. So I'll say that. That's Shudar Amah 125. If you want to look it up, there's only, I think, about 127. So it's towards the end of the Shudar Amah. So the one I'll just quickly discuss, just one last point about it, is Shudar Amah 7, which he wrote to the Maharshal. What did he write to the Maharshal? The Maharshal wrote him a very nasty letter in terms of his how tough he was. Meaning, wasn't nasty. He was said with respect. But it was very, very tough in that he said, Rama, I saw something you wrote, and you quoted Aristotle. How could you be learning Aristotle? How could you do such a thing? So the Rama, in his seventh tshuva, defends himself from the Marshal, and he says, don't worry, I only learnt it from the writings of the Rambam. I never learnt it from Aristotle's writings directly. And even that, I only did on my downtime on Shabbos. I read the Mora on the side. So don't worry, I'm still okay. I never actually learned Aristotle. I only learned it from the Rambam, and nobody could tell me that learning the Rambam isn't appropriate. So I'm all okay, and I found that one to be of great interest.
I'll just say something about the cemetery itself. As we walked around it, how did this survive? So, you know, the Hasidic Shemai Salach about, you know, the Nazi came and wanted to break the Ramah's kever, and then the hammer bounced back and hit him in the head and those kind of things. In fact, even pre-war, somewhat shockingly given the importance of the people here, even pre-war, this cemetery was in some state of disrepair. By that time, the community had already moved its active cemetery elsewhere. And during various battles that took place here, during various invasions, they actually already there are several layers of kvarot, and they even dumped more on it in order to protect the tombstones, and then they didn't uncover them properly. After the war, the people came back, and really was in shambles, in the sense that many of the tombstones had been buried, many of them were broken. Rabbi Yezer Silver, an American Rav from Cincinnati, he was actually chief rabbi of the United States and Canada.
Wow.
At least that's the way he presented himself. It was sort of self-proclaimed. he joined the American Army as a chaplain after the war to come back and work with the displaced persons, and he was like driven around. And he basically gave himself certain titles and insignias in order to get where he wanted to go. He was apparently quite a character. Oh, it's a very, very important book. Well, if you don't know who Rabbi Yezer Silver is, you should buy the book and read it. But he actually came back and worked on identifying where different kvarot should be. People who were important members of the community, who we know are buried here, but they couldn't find their kever, they actually made new ones and placed them. And then years later, They came and did some kind of archaeological checking here, and sometimes they found the original tombstones. You could have, sometimes you have people here with more than one tombstone, even though we don't know 100% sure where they're buried. So we're going to walk around, we're going to see kvarot that were redone, and be'erach, where the people were buried, but you should be aware that this is a very, very confusing cemetery as far as actual burial is concerned.
Is this actually the Ramah is buried?
We know where the Ramah is buried. There's a picture of the tree pre-war with people coming on Lag BaOmer. He passed away on Lag BaOmer, standing next to his kever. So we're fairly certain, because of the proximity of the building and where it's situated and the tree, we know where that is. We also know the people who were, we walked in at the back of the cemetery. Right, the front of the cemetery is the doorway, which is today a window on the other side. That's where the Chashim Rabbanim are buried, aside from the Ramah, who was buried right next to his house, his shul. So again, since we know where the Rabbanim were buried in the very, very first door of the cemetery, we know pretty much where people were. But aside from that, most of the inside of the cemetery, it was just a
Heilige Yidden.
Yes, many holy Jews are buried here.
Those who attended the Tish Friday night heard me tell a story from Rav Eliezer Silver.
That's a new grave, though?